Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Lieutenant Commander John Goodwin, OBE, RNZ, VR, who gives a first-hand account of his escape from Hong Kong in July 1944, after having been captured by the Japanese on Christmas Day, 25th of December 1941. It was recorded 11th of April 1980, and the duration is 55 minutes.
Well, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear all right? Okay. I'm supposed to talk about an escape from Hong Kong, so I'd better get on with it, not waste any time. In May 1944, all the prisoners in the Argyle Street camp in Hong Kong, in Kowloon, were transferred to the Sham Shui Po camp, also in Kowloon, but this one was on the waterfront. That meant that any prospective escaper who was once outside the wire had a fairly safe method of exit from the vicinity of the camp. So I wasted no time in having a look at the fences as soon as we got to Sham Shui Po. The main fences around the camp were, there were four electrified wires standing out about 9 inches from the posts on steel brackets, and behind those electrified wires there was heavy wire mesh, and above that four strands of barbed wire, and above that again a roll of concertina wire. It was a fairly hefty sort of a fence. Now outside that fence there was an exercise yard where we could tramp around in the daytime, and the fence outside that had three electrified wires and the usual heavy mesh as well. But one day when I was having a look at that fence, I saw that one of the posts was prized up a bit, a few inches, and it was high enough for a thin person to slide under the bottom electrified wire. Also, the wire mesh had been cut alongside that post, and the cut was hidden by long grass. So from the moment I saw that, the second fence was not an obstacle at all. That was easy. And in the ensuing days, I had chosen a post that I would climb to get over the first electrified fence. And from that post, I used to walk across to the gap in the other one with my eyes shut so that I'd know exactly the direction I had to take. You have to understand that the only way to go from the camp, it had to be intensely dark, so dark that you couldn't see 10 feet. So you had to be able to know where you were going in those conditions. And that was all very fine, but there were also roving patrols outside the wire, a Japanese with a tracker dog, and about a month after we got there, the dog was placed in a kennel on the waterfront, on the sea wall, about 50 yards from the corner of the camp. And that made that a pretty secure sort of a holding place. But then, 2 weeks after that, the Japanese brought some drums of oil along by the roadside, and they shifted the dog from the sea wall over to those drums of oil. So it was obvious he was going to look after those for the future. That when I saw that dog go, that raised my hopes. I knew that I was going to get out of that camp fairly soon. The weather was a problem. It was the typhoon season, July, and all the time we'd been in Hong Kong, whenever the typhoons came along, the whole place would be lit like day with lightning, and that of course made attempted escape impossible. But this time, on the night of the 16th, 17th of July, there was a typhoon roaring over Hong Kong with its usual fierce squalls and tremendous downpours of rain. And there was not one flash of lightning. It was completely dark. These were my ideal conditions for going. And so the perimeter lights on the camp went out at midnight. And when they went out, I had to wait a bit longer because there were some visitors in the hut, and they had to wait for them to go back to their own place. When they'd gone, everything was quiet outside except for the storm. And I slipped off my bed and out the door and along to this post that I'd decided to climb. Well, it was all right, I got that far, and I was just about to try to step up onto an insulator when I heard the tramp of feet coming, and it was the 1 o'clock change of guard. The guards around the camp were changed every hour, and these chaps came along. I was on one side of a drain by the camp, and they were on the other side, not more than 10 feet away. And I had no cover over me at all. I just lay on the ground. And I could see them in silhouette against the sky, but they could only see blackness looking down. But then I had to wait for the returning guards to come past, the ones that had been relieved. They went on their way back to the guardhouse. And then I had another go at the fence. And I tried to get up on my right foot. I should say first that I chose a post with a second wire insulator and a top insulator. Each post only had 2 insulators but 4 wires, you see, and there'd be a bottom insulator and a third wire and a second insulator and a top wire. And I chose the second and top so that once I was on the top insulator I'd be clear of the electric wires. Well, I tried to get my right foot up onto the second insulator, and after 3 attempts I had to give it away. I just couldn't get up, and I thought that was the end of the attempt for me, until I remembered that my right leg had been damaged by a shell splinter, and although I didn't think there was any permanent damage, I realized there might have been, so I changed over to my left foot. And this time I was up with the first attempt on top of the little insulator. Well, it was a big strain standing on that little porcelain top, and the next thing was to get up onto the top one. And to do that I had to get a fresh hold on the post above the concertina wire. That was a tricky operation because I couldn't keep my bare leg off the third wire, the third electrified wire. I was jammed hard against that while I was groping around, and if I'd touched any of the concertina wire or anything up there, it would have made a circuit and I'd have been fried. So it was a rather uncomfortable time. But anyway, I finally got a good grip on the post and up onto the top insulator. I wasted no time on that, stepping across onto the top barbed wire of the fence, and then I had to get over the concertina wire. And the struggle I had to get over that, it was the only time on my whole trip that I thought I wasn't going to make it. It was a tremendous effort because the steel wire sprang back at you all the time, and I had to get a leg over perhaps 2 strands of wire and down onto the middle wires to below, and then another leg over 2 strands, and it took a long time and very exhausting trying to get over that. It was raining and blowing like the dickens, and there was so much noise on the fence with all the lamps rattling and everything that there was no chance of the guards hearing me. So I was quite secure in that way. But I finally got my legs over the outside of the wire, and I was sort of rolled up over it with about 12 barbs in my stomach and chest and all the rest of it. But I had no way of climbing down the outside of the fence, no hope at all. So just had to, I let go with my hands and straightened my knees, pushed as hard as I could, and landed with a mighty thump on my back on the ground. Then up immediately and for the second fence, and I slid my pack under that and followed it through, and then made for the seawall. On the seawall there were just ordinary barbed wire, just a dilapidated fence, seemed to be no problem, but I was just rolling through that to get onto the top of the wall when I got a terrific electric shock and nearly threw me, and I wondered what on earth had happened, but luckily it cut out immediately and I was through onto the side. Well, then I had a length of rope with me and pushed that round a post, dropped both ends over and down onto the sandy mud bottom down below, and started to walk out towards the sea. But I'd only gone a little way and there was a tremendous fireworks display over my head with blue flashes and sparks flying everywhere. And that was the origin of the shock I'd got on the fence. There was a loose wire flailing in the wind, and every time it hit the electrified wires it was kicking up these sparks and things and setting the ordinary fence alive too. But that was the problem there. But that didn't worry me, because the Japanese were looking after that part of it. There were two guards up there arguing the point, trying to decide what they were going to do about it. But I was on my way then, going out to the sea. And in my kit that I'd always kept ready for these emergencies, I had two Mae West life jackets. And when I got to the sea, I put one of those on my pack and one on myself, and headed out into the bay. It was not a pleasant swim at all. It was half a mile across Sanctuary Bay, and the bay was full of big junks, and they were flying around on their anchors in the willy-wars that were whistling down from the hills, and these things would come bearing down on me, looking as if they were going to overwhelm me altogether. And it was very nasty work trying to get through these things, trying to avoid them. And the only way I could keep direction was by keeping the wind on the right side of my head. I knew I was going in generally in the right direction as long as the wind was on the side of my head. And eventually I did get across to the shore, made a false landing in among some boatyards, but I'd seen those from the camp, so I knew which way to go, and I soon found the little beach that led up to the road. Up there I got on the side of the road and then didn't know where to go. My aim was to get in the hills above the buildings, but I didn't know how to get there. I'd never been on the shore, and I was standing at the side of the road waiting, trying to decide what to do, and I heard someone coming along the road in wooden clogs thumping along the opposite side of the road. So I just waited for him, and when he was directly opposite me, a powerful torch beam shone out from right alongside me and held this walker in its beam. Unknown to either of us, I was standing within 3 feet of a Japanese sentry, and neither of us knew it. And he kept the beam on this chap walking, and as he followed him, it showed up the entrance to a small lane leading into a cliff. So as soon as he put his torch out, I sidled away a few feet and raced across the road under cover of another heavy deluge of rain and up into this lane. It was a nasty place because it was so steep. It was a cutting. They'd cut the cliff down to make a bit of a yard behind some buildings, and it was very steep. But I didn't have time to wait then. I just had to claw my way up as best I could, and it was a very tiring little job until I got my hands over the top and found some tuft of grass to pull myself up by. Well, I had a bit of a spell on top and then continued on my way, and I don't think I mentioned this, that When I left the camp, I was wearing shoes because I had to, I wanted something on my feet while I was standing on the wires. It was too hard to stand on my feet. But as soon as I got into the shore after swimming, I took my shoes off, and most of the rest of my journey they were hanging around my neck because they were too noisy to walk in, and they were no help anyway. So where did I get to?
Top of the cliff.
Yes, the top of the cliff, yes. That's right. Well, now, from there on, I had nothing on my feet because the only way I could get along was to feel the ground. It was so dark, I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see the ground at all. And I just had to follow my feet along and feel where I was going. And I expected the hilltop to go down into a shallow valley and then up to a much higher ridge behind. But when I got over, going down the far side of this ridge, it became very steep all of a sudden, and I was going down an almost a cliff. And then suddenly there was a noise of a waterfall from about 100 feet below me roaring away, and I couldn't see anything, and I felt that I was just going to step over a cliff. So I had to come back and followed the ridge up higher. And that was as far as I could get that night. It was raining all the time. It was pitch black, and I was moving slowly because I had to feel the ground with my feet all the time to feel where I was going or what I was tripping over and one thing or another. And when it started to get light, I had to find some cover for the day. And there were only isolated little pine trees on the hillsides, and the lower branches were up off the ground, and they gave no cover at all until it was getting very light, and I saw one tree that had branches that hung down to the ground, and I just raced for that and got inside it. I had one leg down each side of the small trunk and just sat on the wet ground and lay back and had a rest there. I expected, of course, that the Japanese would be out looking for me all day, but nothing happened. And the day passed. There were workmen working at some water pipes, and from the tree that I was hiding in, I could see three lines of pipes that went away down into this gully. They went out of sight. But then I saw them on the other side again. They were crossed over a little bridge. And I managed to go down to those in the evening. And I had gone over the bridge at the bottom of this gulch and up the other side. And when I got to the top of the edge of the gorge, a whole line of Japanese troops came over the hillside that I'd just left. And they were probing everywhere with torches looking for me. But luckily they didn't cross the stream. They just came to the edge of the gorge and then they went back. And I continued on and over the next lot of hills until there were other patrols coming up every valley. There were Japanese patrols coming up. But it was so dark that they were shouting to each other all the time, and they were using torches to see the ground, so they were no problem. I could see where they were and hear where they were, and I just was able to walk behind them or in front of them just as the thing worked out. And so that was another day. I was on my way, and what happened next? Oh, I got down into a valley, and it started to get daylight when I was down in this valley, and there was no cover. It was a bare sort of a valley. All the cover had been cut off it, and I was at a loss what to do, and I hurried down a gully, and looked up behind me, and there was the Japanese guardhouse on top of a hill just behind me. So that was no good. I had to rush down out of their sight and got into this gully again, and there was a water course in it. It had been scoured out, and it was just big enough for me to lie in. There was no cover over me at all, and I just lay in the bottom of this little gully. And then a Japanese patrol came down directly opposite me, and two men broke off, and they sat on a rock there about 300 yards away, I suppose. And the rest of the patrol came along, and they went up in the gully alongside the one in which I was. I couldn't quite see them. Their heads were just below the ridge. And they went past, but these two that were left behind, they stayed there for about 3 hours, and I could have murdered them. It was very uncomfortable lying in this narrow gulch in the cave, and ants were biting my cut feet, and I was very uncomfortable. But those two men, they went away after about 3 hours and left me alone. So I was then on my own again until darkness came, and I was able to get going once more on my journey. And this next day was not a very good one. I was making progress all right, but I wasn't getting anywhere much. Not in the day, I'm talking about the night, getting mixed up. It was the next night I was going, and I wasn't making a great deal of progress because I was falling over things all the time, and feeling with my feet on the tracks, it took a long time, and I got tired, I suppose. And going along one track, I failed to notice it was on the face of a cliff, and I went along it and failed to notice that it took almost a right-hand turn to the left, and I walked straight ahead into space. And the next thing I remembered was hearing a stream babbling right by my ear, and there was a tremendous weight on my neck, and I couldn't make out what this was until my senses gradually came back and I could see my feet. And what had happened, I'd walked straight ahead off the edge of this almost a precipice and gone down head first between big boulders in a stream bed, and I was resting on the back of my neck in the stream bed, and there was a tremendous strain on it, but I was able to wriggle myself out of that predicament and get upright again, luckily to find that no bones had been broken or any other real damage done. I was very lucky. And friends of mine have said that it was lucky I fell on my head, otherwise I might have been hurt. anyway, I got out of that and continued on to a ridge. I was determined the next night I would find a place where I could see when daylight came. And I did that and came out on a ridge that overlooked the Shing Mun River. I don't know whether you know Hong Kong, any of you people, but the Shing Mun River runs down into Tolo Harbour. And from where I was on this hilltop, I could see the river right from the dam right down to Sha Tin on Tolo Harbour. So I knew exactly where to go on the following night. But I thought I might be able to wriggle down there in the daylight. There were gullies running steeply down to the river from where I was. And I was just going to move out and have a go into one of these gullies when a sentry fired his rifle just behind me. And he stayed there all day. He was talking to someone every now and again, but he was just out of sight of me. I had no cover over me. I was just in a patch of grass. There was a bit of grass up on each side, but nothing over me at all. And if the Jap had walked forward a few yards, he couldn't have helped seeing me. But anyway, he stayed there all day until towards evening. He and whoever he was talking to, they moved off and went back. And I went off down the hill, down into the Shingmoon River, and waded down in the river for quite a bit of it, but it was intensely dark again, and I couldn't see where I was going. It was raining all the time, and very black. And I got down, I knew I was at Sha Tin, or very near, because there was a big Chinese grave there, and I came across this in the dark, so I knew about where I was, but I couldn't find the road. I couldn't find it at all in the darkness, and I just sat down in among some big trees and just have a bit of a rest. It was blowing a howling gale and it was cold, my teeth were chattering. I was wet through, of course, all the time. And I just waited then for daylight to come, and when it did come, there was a clump of bamboo there, about 10 feet in diameter, I suppose, very thickly grown bamboo. And I climbed inside that to have a stretch out and a bit of a rest. And when it got daylight, I saw a lot of people going past just a few yards down below me. And there was the road that I'd been looking for 4 nights. I was almost on it. And the people walking along it, you know, they sort of alerted me to it. But in the darkness, I couldn't see it because it was wet, and any light that came at all was shining on the wet surface, and I thought it was the river. I didn't realize it was a tar-sealed road. So, anyway, I was very secure inside this bamboo thicket. It was very closely grown and very good indeed. Until a Chinese woman came up from the road. She came scrambling up the bank with a pole on her shoulder and a few pieces of rope and a heavy knife. And I thought, what the devil's she going to do? She came right up straight towards me. And when she got to my thicket, she started chopping away at the bamboo stems. She was after bamboo. And of course, I didn't know what sort of reception I'd get from her, and I hoped that she would desist from her cutting before she saw me. But she kept on hacking away at this bamboo until she cut away the very last row of stems between her and me. And then, you see, her sight was concentrated on her knife where she was chopping, and she didn't see me until she cut the last sticks away. And then her eyes opened like saucers and she jumped over backwards and raced down onto the road. Well, as soon as she saw me, I had my fingers over my mouth like this for her to be silent. And she got the message, apparently, because when she got to the road, people there that had a stall, it was quite obvious they asked her what was the matter, and she just gave them some little laughing reply and kept her secret. She didn't give me away. So that was marvellous. But then, of course, she chopped me out of my cover, and I had nothing to hide me at all. But there was another clump of bamboo, about the same as the one I was in, about 60 feet away. And in a quiet spell, when there was no one about, I raced across and got inside that one. That was only about 10 feet from a track that went past, and there were people passing all day, but I was quite safe in there. They were very thick bamboo, and they couldn't see in. So I stayed there all that day, and that night I got down onto the road as soon as it was dark. There were no movement on the road. I think the Japanese must have enforced a curfew from dark to dawn. So there was no movement on the road, and I got onto that tar-sealed surface, and it was too much of a temptation. I just went on it as hard as I could, through Sha Tin Village, past open doorways where the people were getting their evening meal, and there were lights shining across the road, and I just walked through the lights and kept on going to the Sha Tin Railway Station. That was a guard post. The Japanese were occupying that. And they had floodlights across the road on one side and across the railway lines on the other. So I had to get off the road and go out over the paddy fields to get past them and then back onto the road again. I kept going on the road, had a marvellous walk then, a level walk along the waterfront for 4 or 5 miles, I suppose. And the only other snag was at the railway crossing where the road crossed the railway. There were the Japanese guards there, and I got down into the sea and waded past them in the sea and back onto the road again. And on my way over the hill, quite a strenuous climb to the village of Taipo. And there, I just climbed up onto a spur of Mount Taimoshan. It was just coming daylight, and I got up there so that I could have a look what was happening in the next day. And in the morning, there was another typhoon blowing, a howling gale and pouring rain, and on the mountainside there were clouds of leaves and little branches flying over the ridges. And I didn't quite know what to do, but I thought, well, I must stop here today. And while I was there, the wind eased off and a lot of junks came scudding into the bay and anchored there. And the smaller sampans were coming, and they went up under a bridge and got into more sheltered place. And I thought, well, I'd better steal one of these sampans and continue the journey by sea. I reckoned it would have been much easier than struggling over the land. But I went out, after it was dark, I swam out into the bay, and I examined a dozen or more sampans, and not one of them had an oar or a piece of wood that you could propel it by. I swam out to a small island where there were half a dozen boats hauled up on the shore, but it was just the same story there. The Chinese had long experience, I suppose, of having them stolen, so they immobilized them. There was nothing there that you could push them along with. So that was no good, and I went back to ashore and tried to go over a railway bridge, follow the railway line. And I was going along on that all right until I suddenly came to a gap where two sleepers were missing. I didn't know it. I couldn't see them. I just kept on walking. I thought I was going to walk on sleepers, but I fell through this gap and was lucky, just hooked my arm over a rail as I went down and was able to pull myself back. But I did the wrong thing then. I made a silly decision. I went back. I thought I didn't know where the railway bridge went to, and I was nervous of it after falling through it like that. And so I returned to the to where I'd gone on. But then I got lost, and I was wandering around in Taipo, and I came to the entrance to the railway station. I walked up a sloping road, and suddenly I saw a wristwatch glowing in the darkness just a couple of feet in front of me. And I stopped looking at this thing and wondering what, and the owner of it started to talk to someone else nearby. I thought he was talking to me at first, but it was another sentry. They were one on each side of the gateway into the railway station, and I found afterwards that it was then a gendarmerie headquarters, and I was trying to fight my way in there to get in through the gate. So that was no good. When I saw these two sentries, I backed away out of it and down the road again, and eventually got up onto a spur of Mount Taimoshan. How I got there, I have no idea, because in subsequent years I've been there and tried to find it, and I could find no possible way of getting up onto the mountain where I got to that night. Anyway, in the morning, it was blowing a gale again and raining, and way beyond Taipo, there was a spur of Mount Taimoshan came down, and it ended about 3 miles west of Taipo, And so there was no one out. It was a frightful day. There was no one out in the fields. So using the contour of the gullies and things, I made my way up this mountain until I could cross over to the ridge that I wanted to go down. And on the way, I had to go through three rushing streams that were pouring down the mountain in the gullies, and it was absolutely marvellous. The rain had been beating on my bare head for 6 days and nights, and when I got to these streams, I just stuck my head into the water, and it was marvellous to feel the solid water pouring over me instead of this pattering rain all the time. And so I had three of those showers to go through. And then it was getting fairly late in the afternoon. The wind died away and the rain stopped, and I had a pleasant walk down this ridge down to near the bottom of it. And from there was a big village out in the middle of rice paddies, and half a mile away there was a small stone bridge over the stream, and at the far end of the bridge was the road to Fan Ling. And so as soon as it was dark, I went off down here and waded round the edge of the paddy fields at the bottom of the edge of the hills until I came to that bridge, went across, and I was on my way again on the road. And it was good walking, level tar sealed road, and it was good going, but I don't know what time it was, sometime in the night, I suddenly felt that there was some danger ahead of me, and I jumped over the side of the road. It was built up over paddy fields on an embankment about 8 feet high, and I jumped over the side and grabbed a little tree like that at the edge of the road, and my face was on level with the roadway. And just as I went over, the legs of a Japanese soldier went past just in front of me, about 2 feet from me. And there were six men in the patrol. They filed past, and they had an Alsatian dog with them. And when this dog came to me, he looked at me in some puzzlement, didn't know what to do. But he just stood there, and he pricked his ears forward, and then he laid them back, and he sniffed the air. He didn't seem to know what to do. And then after a few minutes or so, he just put his head down and went on after the patrol and didn't make a sound. Just talk about luck. It was incredible, really, that any dog would go past like that without barking. But my life was hanging on his decision whether he'd bark or not. It wasn't good. So anyway, after they went past, I got on my way again, and down towards Chateau Coq, which is on the shore of Mers Bay, and it's on the border between Hong Kong and China. And I kept on going down the road until it started to get a bit light in the sky, and so I climbed up on a hill from which I thought I would see Chateau Coq in the morning, but when the light came, I had stopped too soon, and there were just lines of mountains and the road snaking along down a valley. But anyway, I had a good day's rest up there. It was warm. It had stopped raining for the first time, and I was warm and got dry. That was a great relief. And that night I set off again down towards Chateau Coq, and it was drizzling rain again and pitch black, and I got down and I could see faint silhouettes of buildings alongside me. They were closing in on me, and I suddenly had that feeling of danger again, and I stopped stock still where I was and listened. Nothing seemed to be happening, and then a sentry dropped his rifle on with a crash on the road just a few feet in front of me. So I beat it out of that back along the road where I'd come, and it was too difficult to see anything. It was too dangerous in there. And I went up the hill behind Chateau Coq, climbed up the ridge, intending to cross into China where there were no buildings. But that was easier said than done. Hong Kong hadn't quite finished with me. There was what looked like a fairly level field of grass up there, and I started off to go across this, thinking it would be an easy thing to go across and then turn down towards the coast again. But when I had gone in a few feet, I discovered that it was a field of barbed wire entanglements, and the grass was over 2 feet high and hiding all this wire. And it was much too painful getting along in that, and I was afraid that I'd get caught in daylight out in the middle of that, and I couldn't get out of it. I could only move very slowly in all this tangle. So I came back to the road, retraced my steps a bit, and went down into a gorge where there was a stream running in the bottom, and it by that time daylight was starting to come, and in no time it seemed there were people walking down a track to Shadow Kok. They were just on the other side of a stream, and they were all on their way down taking vegetables to the market for sale and that sort of thing. So that showed me where I was to go the next night, and I just hid down by that stream all day, and as soon as it was dark, on my way again down to Shadow Kok. It was not a nice night. It was a nasty night, because I was getting mixed up with wire entanglements and dodging sentries, and there seemed to be one difficulty after another, and not being able to know where I was, I couldn't see anything. But eventually I came out onto the beach. I got down between some buildings and got out onto a lovely wide beach and set off along that, and there were sentries guarding that beach from the sand hills down to the sea. They were walking up and down there, shining powerful torches about as they went. So as soon as I'd got safe enough, I just went out into the sea up to my chin and waded past quite slowly to keep the phosphorescence down. It was very phosphorescent water. And I had my pack on my left shoulder in case anyone started shooting. and went past them and came back onto the beach again when I was clear and on my way. It was good going along the beach, and eventually in the early morning it started to blow again very hard and pour with rain, and I came to a place where there was an earth bank about 6 feet high that came down to the sand. And in the lee of that I was able to find a fair bit of shelter from the wind, that was. But my bed was over 3 inches deep in water. There was no point in moving anywhere, because the part of me that was submerged was warmer than the rest of me. So it was more comfortable in the water than out of it. So those were the conditions until late afternoon, when the rain stopped and some men came along a path that was between me and the sea. I didn't know it was there, but these chaps came along and went past. And as soon as it was dark, I took off along that path, which was a mistake, because without me knowing it, the path turned inland. And I kept on following this thing and came to a big village, which caused me some bother. I got into it and had a job to get out of it, but eventually did break out. And when the daylight came, there were ranges of mountains where I thought the sea should be, and it was a ridiculous situation. And I could see south of me there was a ridge that came down going eastwards into the rising sun. So I knew that must be going to the coast. And when the first workmen were starting to come out to the fields, I beat it over the paddy fields and up onto that ridge. And in the evening, I went down to the end and saw that it dropped very steeply down to the beach that I'd been on the day before. I'd wasted a whole roundabout going around this and hadn't gained anything. So now that night I followed the coast again. I kept to the beach and kept going along by the sea. I swore I wouldn't leave the sea again. I kept going along that, and in the morning I found myself at a headland, a very steep headland that jutted out into the sea. And what to do now, I didn't quite know, but I thought, well, I might be able to get round that in the daylight, go round the cliffs and come in on the other side. But it wasn't to be. I started going round the cliff, and for some reason, sheer fatigue, I fainted on a narrow ledge up on about 80 feet above the sea. And I just passed out there, and when I came to, I realized that all my strength was gone. I couldn't go any further on my own. I had to contact someone. So there were people going past on a track up on the hillside, so 300 or 400 feet up, and I decided to go up there and take a chance as to who was there. And when I got to this path, I kept on going, and the first people that came were about four Chinese women. They were carrying baskets of vegetables going to a market in a village called Sha Tao there, and when they came to me, they just kept their eyes averted and kept going. And then the next ones that came were three men. I could see these chaps coming, and it was very obvious that they were interested in me too. And as they came near me, I saw that they were trained also, because one of them kept his position on the track, and the other two came out to the side so that they had me completely in their grip. You know, I couldn't get past anyway. And when they came to me and we met and stopped, there was a village in sight behind the beach down below, and I said, "Any Japanese down there?" And one of these men said, "No, no Japanese." And that was all the English we could get out of each other. But we had a long conversation in pantomime, and they wanted me to go down to this village. And I wanted one of them to go with me if I was going down there, because I thought I might get shot marching into a village like that. But they indicated that they couldn't go, and they were throwing things and giving illustration of explosions. I thought they might have been going out to dynamite fish or something like that. But they had a little consultation among themselves, and one of the chaps opened his jacket and they had strings of hand grenades around his chest. They were, although I didn't know it at the time, they were communist guerrillas going out on a job. And of course, I didn't know that. I didn't know whose side they were on when I left them. But I had to go down to the village. I had to contact someone. I had no food. I was terribly weak, you know, finished. And so I just went down to that village, and the people there took me prisoner. No one could speak English, so they sent off to get an interpreter from somewhere. But they wouldn't let me go. I had to just stay there. But I let them know that I was hungry, and they produced cakes and scones and things, gave me a marvelous meal for a change. I waited there for some time, and then what they called the Chinese policeman came down, and he could speak a bit of English. And he wasn't very satisfied with me, and he looked as if he'd rather be shooting me than letting me go. But they said I couldn't stay there because the Japanese came through quite frequently and I must go to the next village. And they deputed a man to act as my guide to take me to the next village. And this chap was terribly nervous, and he started off at a pace that I couldn't possibly match. I could only go very slowly. But he was trying to hurry me up all the time, but eventually we got to the next village. And I stayed there that night, and the next day they took me in a sampan over to the northwest corner of Mers Bay, and that was manned by communist guerrillas, quite strongly manned too, and they looked after me there for about 8 days. and till they sort of got me on my feet again, because I was really quite sick. My feet were cut to pieces, and I'd had virtually very little food for a week. I was eating five dessert spoon, level dessert spoons full of soybean powder and one spoonful of peanut oil, a bit of black pepper on it. That had been my meals night and morning for over a week. So, you know, I was feeling very tired. But however, these people, they looked after me very well. I'm talking too long. And I'll just finish it off. They, communists, passed me on to nationalist Chinese troops, who in turn passed me on to British agents who were working down in China. And eventually, after 2 months by road and river, I got to Kualin. And I arrived there on the day the general evacuation order was issued. I came up from the southeast, and the Japs were coming in from the northeast. So I was lucky and got a trip on a plane over to Kunming. So that was the end of my real hardships. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.